You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Justice Lit. We are back with another episode of the Shakespeare series. We left off at Sonnet 126 last episode, and so we'll be starting off with 127. Wow, I can't believe it's already been this much, and I really feel like sonnets 1 to 5, just starting off the sonnet series was yesterday. I really feel that way, but we have come a long way, and I'm having lots of fun. I hope you guys are as well. Lots of deep analysis, which I enjoy doing, and so I hope you guys also enjoy engaging and hearing me speak about the sonnets as well. We have plenty of sonnets to go through today, and so after some ads and show promos and PSAs, I'll introduce you to the first song I will play, and then we'll get right into the sonnets. So just sit back, and we'll be right back after the ads, show promos, and PSAs.
What do you love, and what do you love about it? My name is Ewan, and with I Love You Hour, I want to know. Come join me bi-weekly Tuesdays at 6 p.m. to discuss music and the stories we connect to it, either in person, on the phone, or through messages at I Love You Hour on Instagram. That's I-L-U-V-U Hour on Instagram, or through email at iluvhour@gmail.com. If you love sharing music and telling stories, listen to I Love You Hour bi-weekly at CITR 101.9. And remember, I love you.
Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's RIDEON Bike Shop. See you there. If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read.
Do you want to advertise with CITR Radio and Discorder Magazine? Well, good news, you can. Our copies of Discorder Magazine span 6,000 square kilometers and reach 3 million inhabitants across 32 locations here in Vancouver. Advertising with Discorder Magazine means being seen from UBC to New Westminster. Along with print, we offer advertising online, offering you a viewership to over 100,000 engaging with our content. From radio ads to Discorder Magazine and our online presence, CITR and Discorder Magazine knows how to get you seen. Contact sponsorship at CITR.ca to get advertising today. Sponsorship at CITR.ca.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show, but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
Those were some ads, show promos, and PSAs. And for the first song, I have Floatin' by Nicole Summerlin. I have introduced her on this show and played her couple of her songs way back. I believe it was almost a year ago, but we are bringing her back. And so Floatin' would be the first song to start off the day. We'll be right back after this. You just finished listening to Floatin' by Nicole Summerlin. We'll start off with Sonnet 127. In the old age, Black was not counted fair, or if it were, it bore not beauty's name. But now is black beauty's successive here, hair, and beauty slandered with a bestard shame. For since each hand hath put on nature's power, fairing the foul with art's false borrowed face, sweet beauty hath no name, no holy bower, but is profaned if not lives in disgrace. Therefore my mistress's eyes are raven black, her eyes are suited, and they mourners seem, at such who not born fair no beauty lack, slandering creation with a false esteem. Yet so they mourn, becoming of their woe, that every tongue says beauty should look so. Now here the poet defends his love of a mistress who does not seem and meet the conventional standard of beauty by claiming that her dark eyes and hair and perhaps her dark skin are now a new standard. The old version of beauty, which include blonde hair and light skin, are so readily counterfeited that beauty in that form is not and no longer trusted. And so with lines 1 to 2, we see that Shakespeare begins by establishing a historical contrast, where in the past, seen in the phrase old age, black, which may refer to dark skin or dark eyes or dark hair or just dark aesthetic qualities, was not considered beautiful. Even if such features were appreciated, they were not granted the title or authority of beauty. The phrase bore not beauty's name implies a socially constructed taxonomy of beauty in which names and categories confer legitimacy. And so blackness in this earlier context existed outside the realm of acceptable beauty. And so we can kind of get a sense of the beauty standards of Shakespeare's time. Lines 3 and 4, however, in a reversal, blackness here inherits the status of beauty. But again, this inheritance is fraught. The phrase successive hair suggests both a legitimization and succession. However, it's paradoxical. We see that beauty itself is quote-unquote slandered as illegitimate. And this implies that true beauty has been corrupted, perhaps by artifice or moral decline. And the line also introduces tension between natural beauty and the notion of false appearances. With lines 5 and 6, these lines ultimately critique the artificial beautification brought by cosmetics or cultural quote-unquote art. And so the phrase each hand here refers to society at large, where people assume nature's power by altering appearances and making the foul appear fair. This we can see is in a sense Shakespeare's echo of the familiar quote-unquote fair is foul and foul is fair motif. Art becomes an agent of deception, replacing nature with a quote-unquote false borrowed face. And so the idea of imitation that replaces authenticity is seen to recur throughout, not just these lines, but throughout the poem. With lines 7 and 8, beauty now has no stable identity now. We can see that in the phrase no name. And also, beauty has no stable identity and no sacred space, seen in the phrase no holy bower. The word bower evokes a protective, idyllic enclosure, seen for a heaven for authentic beauty. If loss signals the desecration of beauty's essence, that is relevant in this line here. To be quote-unquote profaned is to be defiled, and beauty, if not desecrated, quote-unquote lives in disgrace, in a sense. In other words, exiled from virtue. And so these two lines ultimately mourn the moral and aesthetic degradation of contemporary taste. With lines 9 and 10, Now the speaker turns to his dark lady, asserting the appropriateness and moral gravity of her black eyes. The conjunction therefore implies causal logic, where because society has falsified beauty, his mistress's unaltered dark features gain ethical and aesthetic weight. Her quote-unquote raven black eyes are not only natural, but mourners, in a sense grieving for the death of authentic beauty. And so the metaphor layers appearance with emotion, and consequently casts her body as elegy. With lines 11 to 12, these couple lines basically delivers Shakespeare's sharpest critique of the poem, where people are not born fair. And however, even though they're not born fair, they appear beautiful through artifice, therefore slandering creation itself. And so the phrase false esteem underlines how cultural value is misplaced, and it is not just a betrayal of nature, but a spiritual affront and a lie about what is worthy. The final couplet is offering us with a paradox. Although the mistress's dark eyes mourn the death of beauty, they do so gracefully, becoming of their woe. And that means that their grief is aesthetically moving and significant in the beauty sense. So much so that public consensus, seen in the phrase every tongue, redefines beauty in her image. Therefore, mourning becomes a new aesthetic ideal, where her authenticity, grief, and refusal to conform become beautiful in themselves. And so to kind of take away this main idea, we can see that beauty now is not surface perfection, but an ethical depth and truth. And so that was Sonnet 127. We'll move on to Sonnet 128. How oft, when thou my music playest, upon that blessed wood whose motion sounds, with thy sweet fingers when thou gently swayst the weary concord that mine ear confounds, do I envy those jacks that nimble leap to kiss the tender inward of thy hand, whilst my poor lips, which should that harvest reap, at that wood's boldness by thee blushing stand, to be so tickled, they would change their state and situation with those dancing chips, over whom thy fingers walk with gentle gait, making dead wood more blessed than living lips. Since saucy Jack so happy are in this, give them thy fingers, me thy lips to kiss. And so the sonnet uses the conventional poetic idea of the poet envying an object being touched by the beloved. And so we can see that in this poem, the object is basically the keyboard of an instrument. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker begins by calling the beloved my music, already collapsing the boundary, the area between person and sound, which can also be implied through subject and art. The repetition of the phrase music doubles as emotional emphasis and sonic mimicry, like an echo or a refrain. The phrase blessed wood refers to the musical instrument, where its strings and wood vibrate under the beloved's fingers. The phrase wiry concord refers to the strings themselves producing harmonious sound. And the phrase mine ear confounds suggests a kind of ecstatic overload where that beauty is so intense it disorients the listener. With lines 5 to 8, here the erotic metaphor intensifies. The jacks, the phrase jacks, are the mechanical levers inside the instrument that strike the strings. And so these are personified as, quote-unquote, leaping, to kiss the inner part of the beloved's hand, the part the speaker longs to touch. The speaker envies even these non-living pieces of wood. The phrase, my poor lips, which should that harvest reap, implies the speaker believes that he deserves that intimacy instead. And so we could see that there's a disjunction between rightful desire and frustrated excess. The instrument, in the phrase dead wood, is bold enough to touch her, while he, alive, must remain at a blushing, bashful distance. With lines 9 to 12, here the speaker imagines the jacks being so sensually stimulated, and we can see that in the phrase tickled, by her fingers that even they might wish to be something else. And so this anthropomorphizing continues the erotic tone of the poem. The phrase dancing chips reinforces both the mechanical motion and playfulness as quote-unquote chips, also wood, become dancers under her hand. Also, the gentle gait, quote-unquote gentle gait of her fingers, renders the instrument not just alive, but quote-unquote more blessed than living lips. And so the speaker is displaced not just by wood, but by the art she creates. The final couplet, it's a frustrating line, and the speaker's frustration reaches its plea. And so if the quote-unquote saucy jacks, also seen in cheeky mechanical parts, gets her fingers, then he should at least be granted her lips. And the contrast here is stark, as the mechanical touch versus human intimacy is played throughout. The phrase sauciness of the jacks only emphasizes the indignity the speaker feels at being outdone and by inanimate things. His request is erotic, direct, and charged with a complex sense of displacement and desire. And so that was Sonnet 128. Before we move on to Sonnet 129, I have a couple songs, one song to play. It is also from Nicole Summerlin, called Black Velvet. We'll be right back after this.
Mississippi in the middle of a highway, Jimmy Rogers on the Victrola up high. Mama's dancing with a baby on her shoulders. Sun is setting like molasses in the sky. The boy could sing, knew how to move everything. Always one more. Thank you.
That was Black Velvet by Nicole Summerlin. We'll move on to Sonnet 129. The expense of spirit in a waste of shame is lust in action until action lust is perjured, murderous, bloody, full of blame, savage, extreme, rude, cruel, not to trust, enjoyed no sooner but despised straight, past reason hunted and no sooner had, past reason hated as he swallowed bait, on purpose laid to make the taker mad, mad in pursuit and in possession so, had having and in quest to have extreme, a bliss in proof and proved a very woe. Before a joy proposed behind a dream, all this the world well knows, yet none knows well, to shun the heaven that lead men to this hell. Now, this sonnet describes what Booth calls the life cycle of lust, a moment of bliss preceded by madness and followed by despair. With lines 1 and 2, the first line establishes a harsh judgment that lust is an expense of spirit, a depletion of one's vital energy and even soul. The word waste evokes both physical waste, like ejaculation, and moral waste, seen as shame, filth, and loss. This double entendre makes the act both biological and existential. The phrase waste of shame also conjures the aftermath of regret and self-disgust. The enjambment between lines 1 and 2 underscores the instability of lust as well. It is not static, but escalating. Before the act, the word lust is already morally compromised and existing in a state of deception and danger. So that was lines 1 and 2. If we look at lines 3 and 4, the accumulating list of adjectives is almost overwhelming. And so these are terms often associated with violent crimes, not with romantic or erotic longing. Lust becomes criminalized and painted as perjured, which is basically false, and murderous, and not to trust, a betrayal not only of others but of the self. And so the line structure itself with the rhyming, the relentless rhyming, evokes breathlessness and excess. Moving on to lines 5 to 8, these lines underscore the inconsistency and self-destructive irony of lust. The syntax is a bit tightening here, which mirrors how quickly pleasure turns into revulsion, and desire is past reason, both in the chase and in the aftermath. And this suggests that lust ultimately overrides rationality. The metaphor of the swallowed bait is crucial, as it kind of illuminates that lust is a trap designed to lure and ensnare. We can also see a bit of a demonic quality here, where pleasure kind of is seen as a form of possession. With lines 9 to 12, line 9 explicitly repeats mad, the phrase mad, linking it to both the desire for and the having of the object. The triplet had, having, and in quest to have collapses time into a continuous loop of extreme experience. And so we can see that the past and present and future are all infected by desire's fever. And what is initially imagined as a bliss is proved a very woe. And so the act of experiencing lust is not just disappointing, but it retroactively spoils the fantasy. And moving on to the final metaphor, before a joy proposed behind a dream, suggests that lust is only alluring in anticipation and becomes illusion or unreality afterwards. The final couplet delivers a moral twist with a paradox that everyone knows the dangers and shame of lust, yet no one knows how to avoid it. And so lust presents itself as heaven, a promise of ecstasy, in other words, but always concludes in hell. And so this closing pair of lines kind of universalizes or unites the poem, and explains how it is not just a personal struggle, but a tragic flaw of human nature itself. Moving on to sonnets 130. My mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. If snow be white, why then her breasts are dun? If hairs be wires, black wires grow on her head. I have seen roses damasked red and white, but no such roses see I in her cheeks. And in some perfumes is there more delight than in the breath that from my mistress reeks. I love to hear her speak, yet well I know that music hath a far more pleasing sound. I grant I never saw a goddess go. My mistress, when she walks, treads on the ground, and yet, by heaven, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare. And so this sonnet kind of plays with poetic conventions in which, for example, the mistress's eyes are compared with the sun, her lips with coral and her cheeks with roses. And his mistress, says the poet, is nothing like this conventional image, but is as lovely as any woman. And so if we look at lines 1 to 4, we can see that Shakespeare opens with a blunt assertion that his mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. And so this anti-simile immediately signals that he will resist conventional idealization. The following comparisons continue this, where we can see that her lips aren't as red as coral, and her skin is not ivory but dun, which is a dull grayish brown, and her hair is likened to black wires. And so these are not compliments, but they are truthful. And he is rejecting the poetic hyperbole in favor of realism, even at the risk of seeming unromantic. Lines 5 and 8, the damasked roses are basically seen as an emblem of beauty, I guess a Renaissance emblem of beauty, but again, Shakespeare denies their presence in his mistress's face. The word reeks in the final line, is deliberately strong, and there's a direct affront to the tradition that compares the beloved's breath to roses or spice. However, still, the line's wit and candor have an odd tenderness to them, as he sees clearly but not unkindly. With lines 9 to 12, the speaker acknowledges affection in the phrase, "I love to hear her speak," but continues to deny fantastical elevation. Music sounds better than her voice, as she walks like a normal person rather than gliding like a goddess. And so these lines are disarming in their honesty, and rather than elevating the beloved to unreachable divine status, he affirms her humanity and accepts and kind of realizes that she is tangible, imperfect, and real. The final couplet, the poem kind of turns into a different section or different meaning. The phrase "and yet" signals that after all this deflation of poetic convention, the speaker still finds his love as rare, as unique and valuable as any idealized woman misrepresented through false compare. And so we see that the poem ends not in mockery, but in sincerity, and that love, through Shakespeare, argues. So we can see that Shakespeare argues that love does not depend on illusion. And so that was Sonnet 130. Moving on, before we move on to Sonnet 131, I'll play two songs for you guys. We're bringing back a bit of international songs again. Again from Jung Hwa. She's a very famous singer, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so we'll play a song called "Go Away Everyone" by Jung Hwa, and "Walk Away" by, of course, Vern Chichu. And so we'll be right back after these two songs.
I keep wishing and hoping you return. I should have never let you walk away. You're the first one I think of in the morning. The last one I think of every night. And sometimes it seems you're even in my dreams. I should never let you walk away. Life we shared together was so I don't know if you really understood the way I felt each day. Time could never take away. I should never let you walk away. There ain't get up in the morning knowing in my mind I should never let you walk away. I keep wishing and hoping you return. I should I think of every night. And sometimes it seems you're even in my dreams. I should never let you walk away. I should
Welcome back. That was Go Away Everyone by Jung Hwa and Walk Away by Vern Chichu. Let's read Sonnet 131. Thou art as Tyrannus, so as thou art as those whose beauties proudly make them cruel. For well thou knowest to my dear doting heart, thou art the fairest and most precious jewel. Yet in good faith some say that thee, behold, thy face hath not the power to make love groan. To say they err, I dare not to be so bold, although I swear it to myself alone. And to be sure that is not false, I swear, a thousand groans, but thinking on thy face, one on another's neck, do witness bear, thy black is fairest in my judgment's place. In nothing art thou black, save in thy deeds, and thence this slander, as I think, proceeds. And so here the poet disagrees with those who say that his mistress is not beautiful enough to make a lover miserable. He groans for her as for any beauty, only her behavior, he says, is ugly. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker begins by calling the beloved Tyrannus, which is harsh, emotionally domineering. So as thou art, which could mean either just as you are or in the same way as. And so this comparison likens the beloved to beautiful woman whose vanity makes them cruel. But immediately, the speaker reveals his emotional vulnerability in the phrase, "My dear doting heart." And so that hopefully captivated and is captivating. And the phrase, "Thou art the fairest and most precious jewel," is a hyperbolic expression of idealized or perhaps irrational adoration. We also kind of feel a tension here as the speaker feels oppressed by his beloved's beauty, yet is powerless to resist it. And so this kind of push and pull between critique and confession kind of marks the emotional core of the poem itself. With lines 5 to 8, here the speaker introduces a public / private split. Some say, the phrase, "some say that the beloved isn't beautiful enough to inspire suffering or longing." And this is in the phrase, "thy face hath not the power to make love groan." And so kind of, it's a sharp contrast to the speaker's own experience. He admits he won't publicly challenge those critiques, and we can see it in the phrase, "I dare not be so bold," and this suggests either cowardice or societal pressure or his awareness that beauty is a matter of perception. However, he continues to affirm her beauty in the privacy of his own thoughts in the phrase, "I swear it to myself alone." And so we see the relationship or the battle between external opinion and inner devotion. With lines 9 to 12, these lines are layered with erotic and emotional and radical implications. And so to kind of just go through step by step, the phrase 1,000 groans marks the physical emotional toll of desire, where his body involuntarily attests to the truth of his attraction. The phrase, "one on another's neck, do witness bear," evokes the image of groans piling up or being shared, perhaps a subtle allusion to sexual longing or even jealousy. The line, "thy black is fairest in my judgment's place," is very crucial. It flips early modern racial aesthetics, and so the racial beauty standards and beauty implications and just aesthetics in general. We could see that the previous poems that we've read, and so around 130, along in the early 130s, it really deals with the beauty standards and the racial implications of beauty itself. And so the phrase, "thy black is fairest to my judgment's place," deals with early racial aesthetics. And to the speaker, however, the blackness, the beloved's blackness, is the standard of beauty. And the phrase, "judgment's place," suggests both his mind and the metaphorical court of beauty standards. The final couplet, here the speaker retreats from his radical admiration. He draws a conventional distinction, where physically she is not black in a negative moral sense, except in thy deeds, implying that her behavior, perhaps cruelty or manipulation, or also infidelity, is the source of the slander. The final couplet therefore reinscribes the racialized moral metaphor of blackness, and this ultimately softens the previous line's defiant revaluation. And so that was Sonnet 131. We kind of went through a slow, in-depth, a slow analysis than usual. We only got through several, but we are out of time, and so we always can go through more next episode, but I'm glad we went through a deep, kind of slow-paced analysis today. We'll leave the rest for the next episode, But today we will finish off here. Let me know if you guys are enjoying this whole process, the songs, the international songs, and just feel free to let me know with whatever you guys want or need. That is the end. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your week, and I will see you guys again on Wednesday of the next week. Thank you all for joining, and see you later. Bye-bye.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. You're listening to CITR.